From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. If you wanted to stick a pin in the map to mark the place where the American oil industry came roaring back, you might well pick a sparsely populated spot in the lonely northeastern corner of North Dakota. Just as the Great Recession threw millions of Americans out of work, there were jobs chasing workers in and around the oil fields there. But those jobs, the people who took those jobs, it was rough and it was wild. A young reporter decided to spend time there, a lot of time, and she's with us today. This hour On Point, living the North Dakota oil boom. You can join us on air or online. Did you go there when all those oil field jobs came online? Are you out there now or headed there now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from St. Paul, Minnesota is Maya Rao. She's a Washington correspondent for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and spent a whole lot of time living, working, and reporting in the North Dakota oil fields. The result is this new book called A Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. We have an excerpt posted on our website, onpointradio.org. Maya, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
What made you decide to chase this story down?
I thought it was just a really fascinating tale that was a great American story. There were so many fascinating threads where you could get a microcosm of America in this place where very few people have an opportunity to go. And I knew also that it would be something that we'd be studying generations from now in history books.
Why was that?
Because it was just a really massive oil boom. It brought people from around the nation, some from around the world. It really transformed this forgotten frontier, and it had a lot of parallels to, phenomenons like the California Gold Rush or the Klondike Gold Rush.
So when you got there, what did you first encounter?
Well, my first trip there was in 2012. So I was really startled by how remote everything was. I'm someone who grew up on the East Coast, so it's really hard to understand just how small these towns are and how far away everything is. One of the things that I experienced and what drew me to decide to come back a lot more is that when I first would ask people, why are you here? They would often give me a very generic answer. Oh, I've come to start a new life, or I've come to find a better job. And often after knowing people for a lot longer, some sort of other unsavory or more complicated reason would emerge. Somebody would say that they were actually a convicted sex offender, or they had a warrant, or they had a DUI. And so this was a place where people, not everybody, but certainly a lot of people who had been on the margins for some reason or another, they were all drawn here to kind of get a new start.
Take just a moment, because the average person has probably heard the word fracking in recent years and not really understand what it involves. I kind of loosely get it. What is hydraulic fracking and horizontal drilling? Why is this something that allowed for this eruption of oil and this explosion of the economy up there?
Well, fracking has been around for a long time in some form. But in North Dakota, and oil has been around in North Dakota for a long time, too, but it just was not profitable to extract. People were often vertically drilling, but the shale rock was too tight to really get oil out. And so once oil prices rose to $100 a barrel and techniques became more advanced, about a decade ago, that really allowed for people to make a lot of money there, and extracting the oil was suddenly worthwhile.
And suddenly it was worthwhile. So tell me about the kinds of jobs that I see jobs here. We printed out some from jobs.bakkenshale.com. They're looking for skilled trades up there in oil and gas. They're looking for oil and gas industry specialists, telecommuting, technical writers, skilled trades, oil field service technicians. What are we talking about when jobs are available up there?
Well, in my book, one of the main subjects of my book was following a truck driver. Truck driving, at least when the boom was first getting started, was the most common job because there were so few pipelines. That's actually what made this boom such a disaster in terms of, a lot of fatal accidents, a lot of problems on the roads. This huge rush of truck drivers was needed to bring fresh water to frack sites, to bring oil from the wells to rail stations, and to bring sand that was also needed in fracking. And also there were a lot of people working on rigs and frack sites. As the oil prices fell and as the boom continued on and sort of stabilized, pipelining continued to be a pretty strong line of work as well. There was just such a need for pipelines to get the trucks off the road. And now a lot of the jobs are more in line with just maintaining the existing oil wells. So there's a lot more jobs in terms of drilling and fracking at the beginning of a boom. But as it goes on, you really need just a few more, just a fewer number of people to just maintain what's already been producing.
You know, in your book, you get such a vivid sense of how the boom has, shall we say, not savory implications, has complicated implications. And it creates a crunch in a variety of ways. We have a clipping of what one of the, I guess, a former mayor of Williston, North Dakota, had to say back in 2012. And he's talking about the population explosion there because of the oil boom. His name was Ward Kozer, if I'm getting it right. And here's what he had to say.
So many people have moved here in the recent past that we are just literally out of housing. There's a lot of construction going on. It's just that when you build homes for four people, six people come.
So there was a lot of economic boom and a lot of in some ways dislocation. How did you see that play out as during your time there?
Well, one thing that a lot of people have heard about the boom and are probably already aware of is that for much of the boom, especially at the peak, there was not enough housing. So developers were really rushing to build as fast as they could. But just as they were getting so much of that infrastructure up in place and there was finally enough that a lot of people could start moving in, oil prices fell. A lot of people began losing their jobs and they just decided to leave. So this was happening around 2015. Apartment developers had spent so much money to invest there and they needed to get that money back. And their rents, though, were just too high, given that the economy was faltering. So there was really this sense of mismatched timing there. And apartment developers in Williston particularly came to City Hall asking that they get rid of man camps. Man camps were seen as rivals to the apartment buildings. They were these trailers, groups of trailers that housed men and were seen as a more temporary type of housing. So city officials really wanted to create a more permanent town and have permanent infrastructure. But there was definitely a very tough period there where developers were complaining about losing a lot of money. A lot of people couldn't afford to stay there, especially because a lot of jobs came with housing. Once people got laid off, they didn't just become jobless, they became homeless. So that all left a lot of bad feelings among many of the people who had come to make their life there and invest there.
I think we have a caller here calling us from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Andrea, go ahead.
Hi, David. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to talk about some of the secondary effects of the oil boom in North Dakota. I lived in Minot for 2 years with my husband. Mm-hmm. And when we got there, things were relatively normal. But in short order, we started losing businesses and we started losing different things that we had become accustomed to, furniture stores and video shops and all sorts of things, because the oil boom was causing people who lived in Minot to go out to the oil fields. And so businesses weren't able to hire people to work for them. And consequently, that shut a lot of businesses down. Also, there was an increase in crime, as you can imagine. You have a sort of a transient population moving into the area. Uh-huh. And their crime rates rose, drug use and rates rose, and also did trash. So for the first time in known history, people in Minot were having to lock their doors.
Well,
it greatly affected the area.
Andrea, thanks for your call. Andrea raises some interesting issues about the unintended consequences. And, you know, readers, people who have not yet read your book may not know the extent to which you say, look, there were a lot of folks brought there. Your list, you have page 44, you have just such an exquisite and extraordinary list. You say, imagine honing a society from these multitudes, pioneers, outcasts, losers, tramps, dreamers, do-gooders, failures. I'm going to drop down 10 lines at random. Investors, marauders, quacks, fighters, profligates, streetwalkers, strivers, artists. I'm going to go 20 lines down. Nobodies, wayfarers, visionaries, card sharps, debtors, fools. I'm going to go to the last line. Reprobates, grifters, renegades, con artists, crazy deal doers, hosers, and meth heads. And then you merge from it at another point and you say, you know, you saw a look in a lot of their faces, freedom, desperation, adventure, meth, money. Perhaps the only time I would harbor a vague respect for a gas station ruffian. You like these guys.
Well, you know, you got to admire anyone who goes out there, even if it's not always for the best reason. But it does take a lot of courage to pick up and make it out there, whether for good or for bad.
So tell me a little, just briefly, sketch out just for the next minute what you did on your reporting, because you did something immersive. You went and took a job yourself.
Yes, that was just for a small part of the reporting. That was for a month. But that was the way I got into this story. I actually took a job cashiering at a place called the Wild Bison Truck Stop. It's in a very small town on Highway 85 between Williston and Watford City. So everyone passes through there. It's on the main highway. And I took that because I wanted to get a sense of a lot of the issues that would be intersecting there. As I said, I was interested in the culture of truck drivers. I was interested in how, at that time, even a mundane job like cashiering, that paid $14 an hour. I was hired on the spot with no background check.
And so you were part, in a sense, of this great gold rush, although with a journalistic intent, as you later informed the people you were writing about. Why don't you hold on with us here? We're learning what life has been like during the oil boom of North Dakota, about the dreamers, the deadbeats, the scammers and winners, those who've been losing their shirts or some who have been losing their lives, others striking it rich, about how you survive in a modern-day frontier. When we come back, we'll talk to a man who's done it. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. I'm talking with reporter Maya Rao about her new book. It's called Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. You can join the conversation. Those people who rushed to North Dakota and brought up oil from lands where it would have been impossible a generation ago. Do you thank the stars when it's less expensive to drive to work, to your kids' schools, to college, to the grocery store? Do you worry about the U.S. economy pursuing more drilling for fossil fuels? And Dakotans call us. What did this energy boom there look like to you? What's it done since to your community? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Maya, I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. It's a voice of a major character in your book, a subject who became a friend. It's Danny Witt. He's been working as a water trucker in North Dakota since 2011. He lives there in the town of Williston with his wife. Today, he joins us from Sarasota, Florida, where he's vacationing. Danny, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what attracted you about this? What appealed to you? What made you go a dozen states away from Florida, where, if I'm not mistaken, you were living at the time, to go do this hard work?
Actually, it was North Carolina.
That's right.
I think one of the things that's difficult in this country now is to get ahead.
Uh-huh.
Many people are struggling, 2 and 3 jobs, and so it was a chance for me to get ahead, not just keep my head above water. So went to an unfamiliar area and tried to make a go of it.
What had you been doing before?
Well, I was actually living out of the country, doing many things. So on my return to the country, it was a bit of a culture shock, and I had encountered a friend who was here doing it and told me about the situation and said, now is the time to try to get into it. So that's what I did. I went to the school to learn how to drive a truck, which I'd never been in before, and found myself in North Dakota.
What was it like operating one of those huge trucks, and what were you doing? What was in your truck? What were you taking? What did it require of you?
Well, at the time, they were doing mostly fracking, so this was it was very raw out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went to school, basically for a month to learn how to drive a truck, and actually got my license through the school, and then went straight out to Dakota. So basically, you have to train much more before you can drive one of those things. And so I went out there raw, not really knowing how to drive, but somehow fell in with some good people that were able to teach me. And scratched and clawed my way to hauling fresh water to the fracks. There's a lot of water that goes into these one of these fracks.
Yep.
So it can go from a week to a month, and you just run as hard as you can and try to fill up the frack with fresh water. So that's what I was hauling, and it's a little more dangerous because it's liquid load, so it moves around the truck, and it's took a long time to really get efficient at it. But like I said, I had a lot of help. So.
Well, let's take a call now. Kevin is calling from Broadhead, Wisconsin. I think he has some common experiences to share. Kevin, go ahead.
Hi, David. Yeah, I went out there in 2013 and 2014.
Uh-huh.
I was a small building contractor, and when everything went south, you know, things went to heck. So I got my CDL and went out there. And
your CDL. Tell listeners what the CDL is, Kevin.
Our commercial driver's license.
Sure. So you went out there to the Bakken Shale.
I had just taken the test and took the road test. Never had any real experience driving a big rig. Went out there and started driving Hotshot, which is a one-ton truck pulling a gooseneck flatbed. And then they taught me to drive a semi after hours until, you know, I was proficient. And then I drove Slick, which is hauling a flatbed or a tanker with a semi. So I've drove for a company that rented all the equipment to the rigs. The rigs rent everything, pumps, hoses, tanks, everything they have out there, they rent. And so I would deliver equipment and set it up on the rigs.
And what did you think of the guys you worked with and who were working in jobs around there?
Well, I worked with a lot of guys who were from all over the country. Most of them, I found, were different kinds of building tradesmen that had lost their shirts like I did.
Uh-huh.
And came out there to try to get back to ground zero and support their families. And we're all far away from our families. We're only going home to visit for 2 weeks every 4 to 6 months. And that's the vast majority of guys. It's the meth heads and the prostitutes and the drug dealers that get all the airplay. You know, you'd uh-huh. think that the whole place was full of criminals.
But it sounds like it wasn't.
Really?
Kevin, thank you so much for your call. Danny Witt, I want to play for you a clip we have. This is from a 2015 report from a joint effort from the PBS NewsHour and the investigative outfit Reveal. You're going to hear former oil field worker Jebediah Stanfill recalling learning that his coworker Brendan Wegner had died in an oil rig explosion on his very first day on the job.
And I go out there and ask him where everybody's at and how many are there. And he just says, "Derek Man's dead. The Derek Man's dead." That's when I looked up and I saw what I've later found out is Brendan burning in the dark.
So, Danny Witt, when you were up there and are up there, you know, how dangerous is this for folks, whether actively extracting the oil themselves or in a lot of the businesses, the trucking that you do and the other kinds of endeavors around it?
Well, it's extremely dangerous, and that's why they pay top dollar. They've made it much safer in recent years, and, you know, we all take that chance. But it can be worth it. I think what's important to note is that you have to keep your eyes open and you have to be willing to change. As human beings grow older, they tend to want to maintain the same habits. But if you look around, keep your eyes open, you can find jobs and change situations that become safer, better pay, benefits as it ebbs and flows. Anytime you're part of a commodity, which I've never been before,
uh-huh.
you have to understand that. So I think many people were laid off and now are soured on it, but it's still one of the best places to get ahead. And I say get ahead in this country. And although the dangers are very real, there's a way to do the job safely, best you can.
Did you feel as though most of your colleagues and people you got to know there came out better than they went in?
The only way to make it in the oil fields, because one thing that hasn't been brought up is the extreme weather.
Uh-huh.
The other thing to note is these roads are not meant for semis. So there's that. Maya can attest to that. And you have to have dreams and goals. If you don't have a goal going out there, you won't do well at all. And most people don't make it. Another thing that's important to note is these companies do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So you get time off. Many of them now pay for you to go home. And a lot of them say it's to detoxify. to get out the toxins that build up as you work on the rigs. And these are all young men's jobs. So they do allow you plenty of time to go home and all benefits. So in there lies the gold part of it. So you just have to, but if you don't have goals or dreams, you're just out there to make up some bucks and go up to Vegas and spend it, you're not going to make it, period.
One of the things mentioned in Maya's book is she touches on the fact that at times a lot of the regulations were loosened by the very companies and industry that went to work there up in the Bakken fields. And my sense is that, you know, trucking and some of the fields like yours were not always strictly by the book. What was your experience?
Well, it can't be by the book, number one. And number two, the guy driving for Walmart 11 hours has nothing to do with my job. I am oil field certified. So it's not just about driving a truck, but I very rarely drive more than three to four hours a day. So the actual part of driving, I get out and do the work. I'm responsible for the work. So an hour at a time, I might work outside in the cold and the elements, which will definitely wake you up. So the rules that apply to over the road, they're more and more every day. They're coming to the oil fields, but they don't necessarily apply. So I don't know how that translates. But the other part of it is that after 6 years out there, I have managed to get a nice home life. So when I've had enough, I get to go home to a nice life. But I don't believe the normal rules of over-the-road truck driving for semis should apply to North Dakota driving.
Last question before we get back to Maya Rao. I wanted to ask you, you're a surfer, if I recall correctly from the book.
Yes.
Right. How comfortable would you be with fracking in the communities near where you like to surf and near where you might want to settle down after your stint doing this is done?
Well, if they're going to do it anywhere, North Dakota is the place to do it. It's not close to a beach. The other thing is it's well below. People think it's affecting the water table. These fracks and the drills, they're inside many iron casings that are concreted. So I'm sure there's risk. I don't know for a fact what they are, but it's like another planet. So I'm hoping to do it for a certain time and move away from that. I'm sure there are some dangers to the fracking, but I know every day they're doing what they can to make it safer.
Well, Danny Witt lives in Williston, North Dakota with his wife. He's been working as a water trucker in the oil fields there since 2011. Danny, thanks so much for taking the time. Appreciate hearing your story.
Thank you for having me.
Maya Rao, Danny was a fun, colorful, lively character, a thread, a through line in your book. How typical is he of the folks that you met, or how singular was he?
One thing that I found interesting about his story, at least the time that I was working with him, was he was really moving through life at that time in a place of really a lot of solitude. It was really difficult to just be alone constantly and to work in some of the most remote places in the country. And I thought, that there was something fascinating about that, that there are a lot of people out there who really are just living this life of work and sleep and going to the truck stop, and you're just alone. Your family isn't there with you yet, and their only life is just going to the oil sites and kind of living in this really raw, out-of-the-way place.
You know, I wanted to allude to something Danny talked about, which he talked about the protections there. Greenpeace, obviously, an environmental activism group, it says, in order to frack an enormous amount of water is mixed with various toxic chemical compounds to create frack fluid. This frack fluid is further contaminated by heavy metals, radioactive elements that exist naturally in the shale. A significant portion of that fluid returns to the surface where it can spill or be dumped into rivers and streams. Underground water supplies can also be contaminated by fracking through migration of gas and frack fluid underground. Maya Rao, what did you hear about from people either in those communities, around the state, officials or activists, about what the legacy was, the physical legacy to the lands there?
Well, in the book, I write about a really major pipeline spill. They spilled 3 million gallons of brine, the salty byproduct of oil production. And once that spills on the land, it really can't be remediated. So that was something that was very controversial. But I noticed, North Dakota, unlike other states that have heavy fracking activity, North Dakota does not have sort of traditional environmental activism. People also, I mean, they're not really against fracking. They just want to see it done correctly. And they have mixed feelings about not wanting to see their land ruined, but also having just been traditionally wary of more government regulation and more government intrusion. So they were really coming to grips with wanting to preserve this land that was so beautiful to them and so untouched for many generations, and trying to figure out how to make that coexist with fracking.
You know, we talk about different kinds of repercussions, different kinds of outcomes. Obviously, there's the question of the environment. There's the boom. I mean, a lot of money was pouring in, as you say. But it is weird to hear about how that plays out for people who are not among the wealthier folks. We've got a call here from Hampton, Virginia. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, David. I was calling about I was up in Minot for about 4 years in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my friends there ended up being the people working in the oil fields, because pretty much in the town is mostly military or oil field workers. And a lot of them were talking about their living conditions, and most of them were in trailers, and they were sharing, you know, videos of how to patch up your trailer so that you don't have negative 70 degree weather in your house.
And how they do that
in the middle of the winter.
How'd
they were
do
using
that?
Essentially duct tape, silicone, and any other type of caulking they could get on any hole they could get on. But still, when you go out to their trailers, it was still cold as cold.
Cold as cold. Robert from Hampton, Virginia, thank you so much for calling. Maya Rao, how did that comport? I mean, people are making, in some cases, twice the minimum wage that they would have in their home states when they traveled to North Dakota, and yet they're living like this. What does that say to you?
Well, when I was cashiering at the truck stop, I thought it was funny that a lot of the cashiers would park their camper down the road, and then they'd come in the truck stop to shower, and they'd start their shift with wet hair. So it's a really strange way of life. And at one point it was extremely dangerous when we had a tornado touchdown. And so if so many people are living in campers and trailers, that's very unsafe given all the wind that happens. And so, luckily, no one was killed, but there were a couple of people injured, and the tornado was flinging these trailers everywhere. So it's not exactly safe also for people to be there with no heat and sleeping with a space heater.
Sure.
That can catch fire. But trailers are good because they prevent – I mean, they can be good because they prevent overbuilding, like we saw with the apartments. They can be quickly packed away if things die down.
The folks who came there for quick work were not the only ones looking to make a buck. We came up with a promotional video we found on YouTube. It features Danny Hogan. He's a character in your book, one of the owners of North Dakota Development LLC. And in this video, he was pointing to a couple of long multi-unit mobile homes in a sandy clearing in North Dakota.
Okay, so what we're building here is commercial lodgings. This particular phase one, is going to be for 204 beds. If you look down there, we already have 12 beds on site. We have another two lorries today that have delivered so far, another 12. There's another lorry on the way.
You might think of him as an entrepreneur. You can hear his British accent. The federal authorities had another word for him. Tell us in the minute we have left a bit about Danny Hogan.
He was one of several British developers who came to the oil field to develop some man camps and solicited millions of dollars from investors around the world, promising really big profits.
Man
but
camps.
The SEC swooped in saying it was a Ponzi scheme. And so I don't know where he is now. He didn't answer the complaint, but it was very representative of this get-rich-quick mentality that went too far on the oil field.
And briefly, just in the next 10, 15 seconds, define for me what a man camp is.
It's a grouping of trailers that house oil field workers, and a lot of times the better ones have meals on site, and it's a place that people really regard as a transient place to live.
Terrific. We're looking at lives lived during the wild North Dakota oil boom this decade, as told in a new book by Minneapolis Star Tribune reporter Maya Rao. She went there and spent all told a year working, watching, and getting to know the characters, the locals, and the newcomers. When we come back, we take a bigger look, broaden it out a bit with Maya Rao and also with a Wall Street Journal reporter who covers energy. We'll talk to them about what made this oil boom different. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics Podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the boom, fizzle, and boom again in the North Dakota oil fields. You can join the conversation as the price of oil climbs again. As the North Dakota fields start opening up again, are you headed there to find work? Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. Maya Rao is with me from St. Paul, Minnesota. Her new book is called Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. I want to bring in another voice right now. Russell Gold is senior energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's been out to North Dakota's Bakken oil fields. He's also been covering the energy comeback all across the country. And he's an author, too. He wrote a book a few years ago called The Boom: How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. Russell joins us from Austin, Texas. Russell, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Russell, put this in context. What do the Bakken fields do for fracking, and where? How would you situate them in sort of America's current energy scenario?
Well, the Bakken fields were, people had been drilling there since the 50s, but at a really low level, no real fracking going on. And then right around 2008, sort of a critical moment in the energy history of our country, a couple of different companies are operating the Bakken, and they realize that they can bring fracking into the Bakken. And the big change is that for about 5 years, companies have been fracking for natural gas. But natural gas is a small molecule. Oil, by comparison, is this big, complicated molecule with lots of carbon and hydrogen strung together. No one thought you could actually get oil out of the rocks using fracking. Companies went up to the Bakken and proved that it could be done. And so really two things happened. First of all, the Bakken just goes nuts, and there's really no other way to put it. Back in the fall of 2008, when this technological breakthrough happened, about 200,000 barrels of oil a day was being produced from the Bakken. But 5 years later, it was up to 1 million barrels a day. So it just goes five times. But more importantly, it sort of opened up everyone's eyes in the oil industry that, yes, you can use fracking and horizontal drilling to get oil out of rocks. And that's why we went as a country from 5 million barrels a day to now 10 million barrels a day, because this same technique, which starts in the Bakken, then goes down to Oklahoma and finally makes its way to the Permian Basin of West Texas, which has now become, once again, one of the giant oil fields in the world.
I'd like to take a call now from Grand Forks, North Dakota. Eileen, I think, is on the line with us. Eileen, weigh in here.
Hi, David. Well, I have some real concerns about how the Bakken has affected us politically, the conversations we're allowed to have in the state. Representative Kramer, Senator Hoeven, and even our Democrat Senator, Heidi Heitkamp, who I went door to door for when she campaigned, these people are not even allowed to talk about climate change, or if they're allowed, perhaps they're choosing not to. I think some of us are assuming that is because they got great campaign donations from the oil industry. So we cannot have the conversation of climate change. Even on the university level and in the newspapers, we're hearing that our universities and our newspapers are also owned by big oil. And
I assume you mean that metaphorically rather than literally, but I understand your point there.
Yeah, I mean it financially.
Sure.
That they are back.
So Eileen, let me turn that to our guests here, and thank you so much for your call. Russell Gold, at times this program and others talk about the Paris Accords. They talk about new cars that run more effectively. They kind of about CAFE standards, the EPA, all the fights in Washington and in the world's capitals. At the same time, this is going on, right? And it seems as though this conversation that we're having today is occurring almost in splendid isolation from other conversations we're having about national and global policies on these things. That is, that this is occurring and there is greater extraction of what we call, fossil fuels, carbon-based energy sources.
Well, look, there's no question. When fracking came along, it extended the life of fossil fuels. I mean, it provided a huge amount of oil and natural gas at a much lower price than anyone thought possible. So it's been a huge boon to the fossil fuel industry. And you know, I hear what your caller is saying. I obviously don't know the specifics of the politics of North Dakota, but
writ large.
But she's not wrong that there have been well-documented instances where academic researchers have tried to look at different issues and were unable to do that because of fossil fuel advocacy and contributions. So it does have a way of limiting, locally at least, discussions. But, you know, at the same time, you need to kind of keep in mind, I mean, I sort of put this all from 10 years ago is when fracking really begins to generate lots more oil in the United States and globally. The last 10 years have been an incredible era for renewable energy and for talk about climate change. I mean, EVs 10 years ago, there was maybe one EV that you could go out and buy in the United States, a hybrid, the Toyota Prius. Now there's dozens that you can buy. Wind and solar were negligible 10 years ago. Now they're major contributors to our electricity. So, you know, at the same time, this is a very complex dynamic story about a changing energy landscape, partly driven by concerns over climate change, partly driven by technology.
Fascinating. Maya Rao, you know, in your book, you document a boom, and as we called it earlier, something of a fizzle, a mini bust. There seems to be something of a boom again. We've got a clip from CNBC. Harold Hamm is CEO of the oil drilling company Continental Resources. He's seen in some quarters as the man most responsible for setting off this recent North Dakota oil boom. Here he was on January speaking to CNBC and saying happy days are here again in the Bakken oil shale region.
The Bakken, let me tell you, you know, its demise was over-exaggerated. The Bakken is back stronger than ever. You know, the technology's worked better there than it has anywhere else. We're still in the third innings of the Bakken development. Our country's drilled 1,600 wells. We've got 4,500 more to go.
Maya Rao, from your time there, from your subsequent reporting, you know, what is it like? To me, reading your book, it seems a little bit like a sugar high. It may be that you end up at a higher level than you started, but it seems as though you kind of get jolted up and jolted back down with the boom and bust cycle of wherever the price is set, you know, often beyond our borders for a gallon of oil.
Right. Well, now the Bakken is having trouble finding workers as oil prices go up. And the book does explain a lot about how, you know, a number of people felt mistreated or they left feeling sort of bitter because they had imagined that this would continue at a high level and at a more consistent, for a more consistent period of time. And so a lot of people have really bad memories and experiences of losing their job and their house all at once, of feeling like everything was overhyped and they left and they've moved on. So I think, you know, that is part of the challenge here of getting people to still feel more confident that they have a longer future there.
I think we have a call from St. Johnsbury, Vermont. David, you're on the air. Good choice of name. Go right ahead.
How's it going, Dave?
Good. It's good.
So, yeah, I was I'm originally from Rhode Island. I went to school for geology. I went out to work in the Bakken as a well site geologist and geosteering consultant. Got the job. Definitely left a bitter taste in my mouth.
Really?
Yeah. I got told, I mean, the company I worked for was great. It was just when the bust happened, it was the time that I got there, so I moved out and everything, and then was kind of left stranded 2,000 miles away from everybody I knew.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, David, I appreciate your call. We've got another call from Rapid City, South Dakota. Judy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Dave. Yeah, I was wondering about the effect on the Indian reservation, Fort Berthel, out there.
Uh-huh.
I know there was a huge infrastructure built there, and what has happened since the bust. Fort Berthel is partly on the Bakken, and I know there was lots of money flowing through there. And does she have any comment on the Indians?
Maya Rao.
Yes, I have a couple chapters about that reservation. I profiled the efforts there of one executive to build a tribal-owned oil company. One of the big controversies was that as the boom was taking off, it was really all these big outside oil companies rushing in and gobbling up all the acreage. So The reservation, of course, did see some benefits, but not as much as they could have seen if they actually owned and operated these wells themselves. So I read about a company called Missouri River Resources and its efforts to try to purchase its own wells. When I was there in 2015, they had drilled their first four. I think they've probably done another round since then, but there's definitely controversy that they own so few of these wells and that they could really use all this oil wealth to build a better community if they had more control.
Fascinating. From Hatton, Missouri, we have Angela calling in. Angela?
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing great. What's your thinking on this?
Okay. Oh, well, you know, just to back up to the previous caller that had called in and, you know, to touch on the getting a job and having them pay your housing and losing it all in the same day. I managed a hotel out there. We had 248 rooms. The prices were insane. It was $672 a week for a single bed, and two beds was $1,140 a week. And
those are New York City prices, right there.
And they're pretty small rooms. But you know, these companies do pay for their housing. But the problem is that when the company decides that you're not a fit for them, you know, you do lose your housing that day. That day, they call up the hotel, they tell them to lock you out of the room, and you have to go right then. And good luck finding a place,
Russell. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Thank you. Thank you so much, Angela, actually. Russell Gold of The Wall Street Journal, how constructive a foundation, I guess I would ask, is this to build upon for a region, for a community? You know, brings a lot of money in. Presumably, the companies do very well and some workers do well. How well do the areas that host these extractions fare ultimately over time as having this as so much of a part of its economy?
Not well. Look, this is the municipal equivalent of riding a bull. You know, there is an outside chance that by the time the bull stops bucking, you're still going to be on it. The chances are you're going to get thrown off. You know, Williston was the fastest growing, Williston, North Dakota, which is right in the heart of this, was the fastest growing small city in the United States for five straight years, according to the Census Bureau. It had to increase its sewer. It had to increase its water. It had to build new roads. It had to build a new airport. You know, right now it's got its bonds, you know, because it had to borrow this money, is junk status, according to Moody's, because it tried to borrow so much money so quickly just to keep the city livable. I mean, all your callers have been making a really similar point. It was hard to find housing. You know, it was hard to build a sewer system that could last, you know, that could keep this. It didn't have a water system that could provide water to the doubling in size almost, you know, within 2 or 3 years. So the city didn't fare well. The state tried to help by providing some special funds, but it wasn't enough. And, you know, right now Williston is not in great shape. And despite what Harold Hamm says, it hasn't bounced back completely. It's still, you know, maybe half of the quarter of the activity it was at the peak. No one really wants to go back to the peak, but it's still sort of struggling along. And I think the legacy for Williston is going to be one of indebtedness for the next generation.
We have one of our listeners from Massachusetts who points out about the release of natural gas could be worse for our climate. We also have, it's almost as though there's a macro version of the micro issue you're talking about. You're saying this is really tough for the local economy. Writ large, I wonder how, you know, the extraction of these fossil fuels seems to propel the use of the fossil fuels here and abroad. And Russell, you've mentioned before that you know, we've had these incredible advances in renewable energies, but can they keep up with these innovations in these loyal standbys, that is, the fuels we're much more familiar with?
Well, right now the answer is no. I mean, you know, they're not quite keeping up and they still require pretty substantial subsidies, but you know, wind has come an incredibly long distance. It's now competitive in many places. And in fact, you talk about North Dakota. North Dakota is right in the middle of the great wind corridor in the United States. There have been any number of wind farms that have been built up there, mostly in the other half, the eastern half of the state, to feed power into the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul area. But it is a struggle. And, you know, your caller brings up a good point. Things were moving so quickly in North Dakota that the state did not want to tell people you can't drill and frack and start producing oil from this well until you have a natural gas pipeline built up. So what was their answer? They would just flare off the natural gas. Well, that's a waste of resource. It adds methane into the atmosphere. It's not good for climate change. And you know, when people would ask the question, well, why are you allowing this to happen? The answer would ultimately come back, well, we don't want to slow down this boom. You know, this was there are many issues that were brought to the surface by this boom. And for me, at least, looking back on it now, I think the biggest one was just how quickly everything happened. There was cheap energy to be had, and almost overnight, area just developed. I mean, it was a classic boom. It was sort of remind me of, you know, the pictures I've seen of East Texas in the 1930s.
Riding the Broncos, you say. In the remaining minute we have left, Maya Rao, we had one listener who wrote in and said that she was appalled by seeing, after 40 years away from North Dakota, going back to college friends and by seeing what the landscape had been done to the landscape by the resurgence of the oil companies there. When you look at North Dakota now, has it been ravaged? Has it been transformed? Is this a productive thing to have occurred? How do you assess what you witnessed and what you reported on for so long?
Well, one of the things that struck me when I first came to North Dakota was all these abandoned farmsteads everywhere from decades and generations ago, when it became too difficult to make a living, so people left. And the last time I was there in 2016, I just saw this junk everywhere, these abandoned trailers and abandoned man camps, abandoned frack tanks. So it was a really interesting contrast of images there to see the same cycle repeat.
Well, that's Maya Rao. She joined us from St. Paul, Minnesota, Washington correspondent for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and fortunately for us, author of Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. Maya, it was a treat to hear about your experiences. Thanks for sharing them.
Thank you.
Russell Gold is senior energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Austin, Texas. Russell, great to have you as well. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on the Facebook at On Point Radio. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.